Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk Leader.
Happy July 2nd to you. It is Wednesday. I'm Andy. Thanks for being here. Dr. David Blodgett also here with me in studio, looking rather dapper in his olive green jacket and tie. Nice, Doc.
Well, thank you.
You look good, man.
That's good
to be
good. Here.
You look like a lawyer almost. Yeah, that's how good you look.
Wow.
I'm glad you're not, though. I'm glad you're a doctor. And nothing against lawyers. I have many lawyer friends, attorneys, some of them. And they were trying to explain to me the difference between a lawyer and an attorney. I never did figure that out. I don't know what that means. It has something to do with how long you're actually in court and stuff. I don't know. But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. In fact, David and I were talking a little bit about stuff that is, religious-based off the air, but we're not here to talk about that either.
Yeah, that's not good either.
I spend too much time on that. Bottom line is, it is summertime. It's on time. Dave Heaton was on earlier on the morning show today, and we talked a little bit about fireworks safety. Obviously, something foremost on public health's mind. I actually had a firefighter Dave tell me the other day. He said, "Will you please tell your listeners not to hold the fireworks when they light them?" I'm like, "Do we really have to say that? Is that something that I guess it is?"
You'd think that would be fairly self-evident, but I don't know. I remember being a kid and throwing them was the idea. But sometimes you just didn't get out fast enough, right?
So I had a scoutmaster when I was a kid. I was 12 year old, and he had a thumb and a pinky, and he didn't have the three fingers in between the thumb and the pinky, and it was a firework. A firework blew up in his hand or something like that, and it was funny though to see him shake someone's hand for the very first time.
Yeah,
he go up and shake their hand, and they would get this look on their face like, "Oh no, what do I do?" He's grabbing me with a claw.
He was used to it, and they weren't.
So. Yeah. So the other obviously public safety thing besides personal safety, also we're a tinderbox right now. We're in an extreme drought, and please don't set those shooting fireworks off in places that aren't designated for it.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't necessarily a public health issue, but it is a, common sense, good citizenship issue. And the fires themselves are being recognized more as a public health issue where you breathe those, that smoke.
Yeah.
Time to be aware, I guess.
I did a story about that, and I found a couple of government websites, and it said that the smoke particulates in this area, now maybe if you're in Pine Valley or close to the fire, are not necessarily that big a health hazard unless you already have a sensitivity, asthma or some other lung problem, and it's worse earlier in the morning, especially like 6 to 10 in the morning.
Well, and I think there is something to be looked at from the standpoint of long-term exposure, weeks, months, years, versus a few days. Yeah. And so if you have a constant exposure to smoke, then they can document, increased rates of COPD and asthma and heart disease and cancer.
If you live in L.A. or something with a lot of smog, right? That same kind of idea.
Anything burned is, a carcinogen.
All right. Another story I did on our website recently was there's a new warning about vapes and how maybe they're not as bad as cigarettes when it comes to nicotine and some of those things, but they're finding that a lot of these new vapes have heavy metals in them. They have metals that can cause harm. And so when you're, I have a friend who vapes. I actually talked to him about this, and he's like, "I'm still going to vape. It doesn't stop me at all. It's still better than cigarettes." And I'm like, "Well, I don't know if it is or not." But he's like, "I get a buzz, and that's why I do it." And he says, "Are you going to stop eating cake and cookies?" And I'm like, "No." And he's not either, though, is the thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think a lot of young people especially look at vapes as the answer to cigarettes. Well, I'm going to fix everything by vaping instead of smoking. And it's not really better.
No, and I don't think we know the final answer to any of those questions, to be honest with you. I think for somebody that actively smokes, switching to vapes might be better than actively smoking.
Okay.
But I don't think that argument holds true with, well, I'm going to start vaping rather than start smoking, because, you know, there's, one, no physiological reason to do it, you know.
Yeah.
eating stuff turns out to be kind of important to survival, but vaping, cigarettes, whatever, there's no survival impulse there. But I this is another example of where the advertising is huge on the side for the vaping, and we just have kind of this lone voice in the wilderness kind of thing going on. And so, I mean, I think the real question is it really worth the cost, the health risks, everything else? And then people make the decisions, right? And I think I'm out of the trying to force people to do anything game. I'm in the game of just making recommendations based on common sense and good science, and so that's where we are.
let me bring up a word that kind of affect, well, does affect public health. The word is addiction. Utah filed a lawsuit against Snap, which is the owner of Snapchat, saying that they are basically getting young people addicted to Snapchat. Now, we're talking kind of mental issues versus physical issues, but addiction has become, you know, it's so big in everything that we do. You could say there's an addiction to sugar, maybe an addiction to a certain kind of soda or diet soda, an addiction obviously to vaping or cigarette smoking, an addiction to alcohol or illicit drugs, an addiction to social media perhaps. So addiction really, it's a big factor for you, isn't it, as a public health official?
Absolutely. It is for everybody. And I think, you know, so some things produce overwhelming tides of dopamine, and they are hugely addictive even after one time use, you know. So you talk about, you know, illicit drugs and things like that. And but this continuum of dopaminergic response to get a stimulus for yourself is wide ranging, right? So maybe it's helpful to go back just a step and say this dopamine feedback loop that we have as part of our physiology is a good thing. It's what's allowed us to survive as a species.
Yeah, otherwise, we wouldn't have it.
Yeah. We have a reward system built in that rewards us when we do things that are productive and helpful, mm-hmm. and get to where we are. So they can show studies where, like, they put up a picture of a baby, right? And you get a little bit of a dopamine hit. Yeah. Or, you know, working through a conflict with your spouse, and then you get, you know, or you finish up a hard task and you get
right.
So all of that was designed to favor positive and good behavior. But we as a society have developed the capacity to hit that dopamine trigger for almost everything.
We figured it out, didn't we, in a bad way.
And so, you know, tapping on your phone constantly is a dopamine hit feedback, right? Yeah. And then there's variations on how intense that is, but ultimately, it's a similar mechanism and has similar kinds of impacts on behavior and things like that, because you seek that dopamine. Now, the problem is when you find ways of getting that dopamine hit that allow you to short circuit or not participate in the things that you need to participate in order to be productive, to build healthy relationships, to learn things you need to learn, all of that kind of stuff. If you're so intent on the dopamine hit and the dopamine feedback that you miss out on everything else in life, then that's become negative, right? And so the more powerful the stimulus, the more likely that is to happen, you know. And so you get into, there's some things we've identified for a long time that's just, you know, really bad form, you know, to, you know, cocaine or whatever, but that's inherent in almost everything people claim as part of their addiction, right, is this dopamine feedback. There are other chemical, you know, feedbacks and magnifiers of that, you know, caffeine, for example. You start to feel less energy, and so you want that hit to come back.
You need more and more and more, yeah.
But It's something I think we need to be more aware of, teach people more about, and be cognizant of. Sometimes you need to just recognize what's going on and take a step back. So here's the other insidious part of this.
Okay.
Because we've talked about this concept of tachyphylaxis, where where a drug just
stops to work
over time. But the same thing happens with dopamine, right? So
really?
So the impact of that activity wanes. And so you need to do more and more of it to get to the same feeling of feedback that you had from that activity before, right? And so it becomes this ensnaring thing where you're like, oh, gotta doom scroll more to get to the same dopamine level that I got before.
I mean, just a simplistic example, if you like pictures of kitty cats, the first time you see a picture of a kitty cat, you might get that dopamine hit. But after you've seen that same picture or a picture similar to it 10 times, you're like, eh. So you keep going and going to get more and more.
So it shows up in illegal drugs where you have to take more and more and more to get to the same place. And there's other effects there, but you know, pornography, it becomes a real problem because it has to be harder and harder and harder core in order to get to that dopamine hit that you're getting, that magnified dopamine hit you're getting. And so it's something really to be aware of. And so part of what you can do to help with that is be cognizant of the fact that I need to take breaks from this sometimes. I just need to pull away and let my whole system reset, get a little clarity on the issues, and then you can come back. And so, you know, if you're a doom scroller and it's just, you know, constantly doom scrolling, maybe part of the answer is to say, I'm not gonna touch my phone for a couple of days and let this kind of reset. Your dopamine receptors will recover. Unfortunately, it's a long time. It's 2 weeks, right?
Wow.
In the world of all of this. And so, just something to be aware of in your constellation of how you live your life and how you get to a happier place and be more confident in who you are and what you're doing and things like that is, this is not a mechanism for long-term success to short circuit a very good system and co-opt it into a system where you've really given up everything else in the name of that dopamine hit. Whatever it is.
So does that, when you talk about a dopamine hit, are you talking about not just, I mean, we're talking about doom scrolling and illicit drugs. What about, take a bite of a really good piece of cheesecake, or blackberry ice cream, whatever it is your favorite thing might be. Is that the same system?
It can have a component of that, right?
Okay.
And that shows up in when people say, well, I eat when I'm depressed, or when I'm nervous,
grab a quart of ice cream and down it.
So there's the actual physical effect of getting the food you need, but there's also the psychological reinforcing of that where the dopamine kind of continues that and makes that feel like you're helping the situation when really you're just covering over what you should be dealing with.
Eating ice cream is all like drinking alcohol, I guess, in that way. You're just trying to cover up whatever.
It turns out that we're really good at avoiding facing up to the hard parts of life.
Yes, we are.
When really, that's when we grow. That's when the improvement happens. That's when good things happen in our life, is when we face up and do the hard parts. And the easier and the more convenient it becomes to short-circuit doing those hard things, the less happy, healthy, productive you are in life.
Okay. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, I've had some people that have worked for or with me here that are young people. We're kind of changing subjects a little bit, but, and they have been less motivated than young people in the past have been, in my opinion. A lot of people say you're wrong. Okay, whatever. But I really felt like the younger generation. So does that mean that your job as a public health official has changed based on the attitudes and efforts of the public? I mean, you know, someone that was 8 years old or 12 years old a few years ago, now they're in your public health realm as an adult raising kids of their own. They're 25 or 30 now.
Yeah.
Has that changed your job? Has that changed the way you do things?
Well, I mean, you have to try and speak to people where they're at to help them progress to where they need to go, or they can go, if they make some of those basic changes in life and things like that. And so we talk a lot more now about things like loneliness, mm-hmm. connectivity.
Yeah, we never talked about that 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
The impact of what's your social network look like? And, mm-hmm.
And not the one online, the real one.
Yeah, the real one where you interact with people. You know, you go back to the 1930s and 40s, people could put down a list of 60 people that they would feel comfortable taking their kids over to drop off for the evening while they did something. Yeah. Now, most people, it's one.
Maybe mom, that's your dad, something like that.
And so there's definitely a shift in the social, integration and construct of our society that's having an impact, right? And so then we talk, well, like, what can you do to help people be more social? And I don't think that's a government solution thing, right? I think it's we need to get back to some of the basics of maybe going and sitting on somebody's couch and having a good evening, just talking to people is something that, should happen every now and then, kind of thing.
You know, we had that COVID period where first school was out for a little while, and then in Utah we went back, but we went back with masks on our faces. And I know my daughters were both, one was a sophomore, one was a senior that year. And my youngest daughter, especially, she said, that kind of killed social life. You couldn't see people's faces anymore. Yeah. You didn't go hang out with them afterwards because, COVID and everything. For a while there was no school, so you didn't even talk to them. Do you think that is a big factor too?
It could. I don't think we know how to even begin to process what some of those things, to be honest with you. And, I think we'll try to get to that, but I think sometimes you run huge social experiments without knowing what you're doing.
And, didn't mean to run a social experiment, but you did.
And even knowing what the impacts were is kind of hard to really tease out from all the other variables of life, So
Earlier today I was doing a search on public health issues, and this one surprised me because it came up on every single list, and that's public health workforce shortages, not enough nurses, doctors, helpers, whatever. Is that a factor in southwestern Utah?
Sure. Yeah? Sure. So we have, 12, 13 nurses that work in the health department, and, the explosion in the demand for nurses and nursing salary really far outpaced where we were able to come close to competing. So it definitely, all of those things impact us. We have to try and compete in the workforce, and sometimes we do better than others, but we're poorly funded, and so it has to be a calling, and you have to be interested in helping others and, going above and beyond in service to your community. And then we live in an environment where people, if you work for the government, you're evil sometimes, we sometimes do fine. A lot of times struggle. The workforce ages out about every 20 years as well. And so you have to try and see what it takes to bring the next generation on. And
so you might have a nurse that has, say, 3 job offers when they come in to interview with them. And unfortunately, you might be the lowest paid of the 3, so you have to make a case, as you were mentioning, for other things, whether it's culture or whether it's, pride and duty. Right? Those are hard sells, aren't they?
Yeah, money wins, right? We have people leave us all the time for a dollar an hour raise, and you're like, but, anyway. So the calculus is hard, but you can only do what the money you have allows you to do, kind of thing. Yeah. And so you have to navigate all of that as part of the art of running an organization, I guess.
Being a manager of people. It strikes me as sometimes maybe, this isn't nice to say, but maybe you're left with ones that you know, or maybe they couldn't get a job somewhere else, or they're having difficulty somewhere else, and then you've got to mold them and figure out how to make them workable.
Sometimes, but I think most of the time we end up with people that are really dedicated to what they do.
That's good. That's good to hear. And I,
they've made the conscious choice to say, you know what, I love the concept of helping people live healthier lives, and I'm willing to make a little bit of a sacrifice in my personal life.
That's tough. And, so. And I will say, we used to have a guy call all the time saying, government employees get pensions, and they get this, that, and the other insurance paid for. And, but I will say that my wife has been a government employee for 30 years. She made less money. In fact, yeah. I did the math once. We estimated somewhere in the neighborhood of $260,000 less. Absolutely. Over the course of her career. Yeah. Yes, she has a pension. Yes, she has health care paid for. So you could, if you factored those in, that's where it would even out theoretically. But she made a lot less money working for the government than she would have made in the very same type job in the private sector.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And to be honest, in this younger generation coming up, they don't understand the benefit side, and so yeah. That's where we suffer. So somebody leaves us for $1 an hour, but they have health insurance,
you know, right? Right, and no pension.
That's a big difference, yeah. You know? And so, I mean, it's all a balancing act. Trying to do the best you can with what you have.
The thing about things like pension and health care, those become more and more important to you as you get older, too. Yeah. And when you're 20 and you're invincible, or 25 and invincible, you don't even think about that kind of thing.
Well, you start to understand there's things about the world you didn't know when you were 20.
So I'm finding out, yeah. All right, let's take a commercial break. Dr. Blodgett on today. We're talking public health. We're going to get an update on the measles and what's happening with measles cases, up to 9 now in the state of Utah. Well, sort of. We'll talk about that when we come back.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Day before yesterday, a judge sentenced the guy it was up in Eagle Mountain, Utah. He was on meth. He was driving 120 miles per hour, went through two retaining fences, a couple of yards, and ended up killing two toddler boys because he was on meth. You and I were talking a little bit about freedom and the fact that people who are on meth aren't free. They think they're free because they're choosing to do that, but holy cow, this guy, now he's in jail, two consecutive 15-to-life sentences for killing those two little boys.
Yeah. Well, and just imagine your conscience, how you feel about that.
He actually said, I wish I could trade places with you and I could feel the pain of losing a loved one and not be the one that did it. And because he did. His conscience got to him. But, I hate to start out on a bummer, but, man, it's just choices have consequences. And you as a public health official probably know that better than anyone else, because we all don't follow your advice very often.
Well, and you don't need to follow my advice.
I mean, I have Dr. Pepper right here. So.
Follow your own advice, right? What is it that works for you and be the best you, right? I think is what we're all trying to get to is do the things we know are right.
Do you
get a little better every day?
Yeah. Do you feel like we've talked about this in the past, being a health official is kind of like being a parent to all of us.
Yeah.
a parent of a teenager where you say, I know what's going to happen if you do this, so please don't do this, and we do it anyway.
Maybe that's a good analogy. You're... What's even more frustrating is when you know better for yourself and you still do it.
Yeah. That's a good point. We've got now 9 measles cases reported in the state of Utah. It's interesting how we are supposed to approach this, but if you're vaccinated, you have, is it 97? Is that 97% chance of not getting measles if you're vaccinated?
Right.
And
right.
So I'm assuming these 9 cases, I don't know, but and maybe you don't know either, but I'm assuming all 9 of them were probably not vaccinated.
Yeah, so far all of them have been not vaccinated.
Yeah. That's... Hello? Why? Well, I don't know.
It's those 3% that are really the gray area here, right? Because most of the time, those are people that have been vaccinated but they have an immune system problem, right? Their spleen got wiped out, or had cancer, or
so it's not just sort of luck or something.
No. Okay. There's very definite reasons why.
Okay.
And so a lot of times when we talk about, hey, you know, this bigger idea of why to get vaccinated, I don't dispute anybody's right to get sick if they want to, right?
Yeah.
But there is this part where you're now in a position to make somebody else sick that can't take advantage of that. Mm. But when we're all vaccinated, then that protects those people too, right? So measles is the most effective of all the vaccines. It's lifelong immunity. It you never get sick from it. Yeah. And really high protection rates, 97-98%. But other vaccines, they're less effective than that as far as that rate. Once you're vaccinated, you know, 90, 95, you know, kinds of, it's still really high, but,
yeah.
But 10% of the population being unable to develop an immune response to a vaccine is a high number. And, yeah. And so when you're talking about some of these really drastic, nasty diseases, the ability to keep them out of society by most people being vaccinated, by everybody being vaccinated, it's called herd immunity. It's the concept, is really important, you know, as we go forward as a society, and we're losing that. And so we'll see a time where diseases that we just never had to deal with are now circulating again in the population.
And
then the ones who pay the highest price for that are the ones that, even if they did get vaccinated, it wouldn't do anything for them.
Because they can't.
And they can't amount an immune response to the disease. So
I think that's important for people to know, because I just learned that just now. I thought it was a luck thing. 97%, the 3% that can get that it doesn't help, I thought it was just they were unlucky, whatever. But there's a reason that it doesn't help them.
Yeah, there is a reason. And I don't know. It's a little more complicated than my body, my right. There is this, you know, we don't want people to speed because you might kill yourself speeding, but you also might kill other people speeding.
Yeah,
right?
If you're going 100.
So there is this... It's called a distributive justice argument that says, you know, as little as you care about yourself, what is it that we as a society should say is important, you know, for how people live their lives? And so, I've never been on the side of forcing everybody to do anything, but I do think it's important to understand what's at stake here as we have this debate about vaccination. So,
you know, and your analogy to speeding is a perfect one, because, and I would carry that on over to driving under the influence. How many times do you read a story in the news where there was a DUI crash, the person who was drunk was hurt, unhurt or barely hurt, but they killed someone else?
Yeah.
You read that over and over and over again. DUI is not to protect you.
Right.
DUI is to protect people that you're going to hurt.
Yes, exactly. And people learn over time that's just not acceptable to allow people to hurt other people, right? And you don't want to hurt other people. I don't think in general people walk around saying, I want to be able to hurt other people.
Yeah, I hope not.
And that's kind of core concept in civilized living. And so just something to be aware of in this debate we've got going on.
Well, and unfortunately, there's a movement out there, a kind of me first, I don't care about anyone else. I don't know that it's a majority movement at this point. It's a small minority. But there are a lot of people out there, Doctor, who are like, I don't care. I just got to take care of me. It doesn't matter what you guys do.
In lots of areas, right? I think immunization is just one area where this is showing up. And I don't know. Yeah, I'm big on pendulums right now. Things swing back and forth. And you come out here and people realize, oh, that wasn't good. And they come back and they swing it too far the other way. And that wasn't good. It's really hard to get down to that right in the sweet spot kind of thing. And it's just... Isn't there a Seinfeld episode on that? You know, it all comes back around. But
I think so.
Anyway.
Every time I think of Seinfeld, I think about that rental car reservation episode where you know how to take the reservation, but you don't know how to hold the reservation. And really, isn't that the most important part? Anyway, I can't get that out of my head.
That's so right.
One of the other things that kept coming up on the public health issue topics was rural health. I've always had a hard time with that. R-U-R-A-L, rural health. Do we have a rural health issue in Utah? We have a lot of farmers and you know, turkey ranchers and things like that. Is that a problem here? Is it, you know, in the Southwest, in your jurisdiction?
I don't know if you saw this or not, but Utah came in number one healthiest state in the nation again. Right. So
we don't smoke here.
Yes, because we don't smoke mostly, but. They always want this to be an underserved area where, you know, you live out far from a hospital. It's harder to get to a hospital. And I think that's where a lot of that concern comes from. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that gap is narrowing, you know, to be honest with you, with the internet, with,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, we're a lot more portable than we've ever been. You can call, get access to people through calling and stuff like that. And even those little hospitals have better access to abilities to move people to other places. But I don't think we're ever going to get to a place where you have as good an access to tertiary high-level care living someplace where there's only 1,000 people in your community as a place like LA where there's 15 million. It just is...
Yeah.
You concentrate the services where there's the most people. And so I always hesitate when I hear that statistic as some big metric of health, not from the standpoint of being aware of it. As somebody, if you live out in the boonies, you got to know, you know, maybe there's a time where you're not going to make it to the hospital just because of how far away you are from something. Yeah. But I don't think that's a condemnation of the system or something, which is what they try and make it sound like.
Does that make sense?
I'm not articulating that very well. I think we do the best we can with where people are at and trying to, you know, make as many things available to as many as we can. But the reality is you got to have a certain population base for a heart specialist to exist, right?
He's going to go to somewhere where he can.
And so yeah. I think when we talk about, well, how can we make sure people have equal access to care? That's always the way they phrase it. It has to be, well, how do we do a better job of getting people from there to here? Without, you know, losing them in the process. And sometimes time matters. It just does.
So. There cannot be equal access to care for a guy that lives in Ephraim versus a guy that lives in Orange County. It just doesn't happen.
It's just the reality of space and time and everything that we deal with. But I think we can always talk about, well, let's make sure you're living as healthy as you can no matter where you are. And you know, have people understand how to access resources to the best they can wherever they are. So
we rented a VRBO home up in Idaho, and we went to Yellowstone, and it was out in the middle of nowhere. Closest house was a half a mile away. You know, there were fields everywhere, but I was thinking a little bit about that. Boy, what if they ever had a health emergency in a place like this? Because we were 15 or 20 minutes from the closest town. Now, when I say the closest town, I'm talking about Ashton, Idaho, with like 1,000 people.
Yeah.
And then it was a good 70 minutes to Pocatello, I think, was the closest city. And, you have a health problem out there, you better be good at taking care of yourself, because it's a long way to a real doctor.
Well, and I think if you go to that rural place sometimes, or maybe you grew up there, whatever, you live there for other reasons, right? There's other quality of life issues that are helpful too. So
breathing in these
smells. So I think all of us do a calculus of the balance of all of that. And I think focusing on that one aspect doesn't give credit to the whole overall picture of where it's at.
Good point.
And so I don't know. I'm trying to be more cautious in my language when we talk about things like that. So.
All right. Let me get a commercial break in. When we come back, I want to talk, if the doctor doesn't mind, talk a little bit about back issues and how that affects each of us every day. I found I had a recent MRI. It was not good on my back, and I won't talk about specifics of that, but certainly something I'm interested in.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk leader.
Hey, welcome back. 9:50 now on KDX. We've got 10 minutes left here with Dr. David Blodgett. If you have a question for Dr. Blodgett, text me at 435-467-5842. You're always welcome to call at 673-5890. We're talking a little bit, well, we are talking a little bit now about backs. I was always under the impression that you had a lot more to do with your back than I'm coming to realize. I had an MRI, got the results back, and I've got some problems with my back. And I was, like a lot of humans, Dr. Blodgett, I was grasping for straw. I was like, why? What did I do? What behavior do I need to change to fix this or whatever? And the doctor was basically like, well, you didn't do anything. It just happened. Yeah. And that's a tough pill to swallow.
Well, and I think there's sometimes when you see events, right? Somebody gets in a car accident or, you know, you can definitely identify something that
right.
pushed you over that edge. But then there's lots of us that... We always call it idiopathic.
Yeah, I hate that word.
Medical world, in the medical world, meaning who knows?
We don't know why.
That's the last thing anybody wants to hear because they want to know why and have a reason
that's
or
so
something.
True.
And, there's this complex mix. People are complex. You know, there's genetics. There's things that happened in your life. There's things that you just bad luck sometimes, and you know, all of that comes into this mix. And I will say back issues and lower back problems are far more common than we give it credit for.
Yeah, I don't think I even realized how common
15-20% of the population
that's
struggles with that. The pain and the mobility and disability issues surrounding it are huge.
But you think about
millions and millions of Americans,
and you, in your Southwest Utah public health, that's you have what 250,000 people, so that would be 10% would be 25,000, 15% would be another throw on another couple thousand or 10,000 or so there.
That's a
lot of people.
So I think in all of these things, sometimes we tend to feel isolated, like we're the only ones dealing with this, and that's not helpful either because there's a lot of people that can help and be part of that. And I think it's an appeal to our better natures to look out for each other and help each other out. So sometimes there's a pretty clear indication of what happened. Sometimes you just got to say, I don't know. Just that's where you're at.
I think the humbling part, too, is that, like, you only get one body. I only have one back. I don't get a do-over, And I think about my father-in-law right now. He's suffering from late stages of Lewy body dementia. And I would like to go back 5 years and talk with him. Having a conversation with him and ask him. I mean, there's simple things like, where do you want to live as this disease takes over your mind? Where do you want to live and how long do you want? Stuff like that. And we can't ask him that anymore. We missed the window to ask him. And now he doesn't even recognize most people anymore. And I just think, I'd sure like to go back and die if I only knew. So maybe that's part of your job, I guess, is to warn people because you only get one shot.
Yeah, you try. And it's always easier to not have it happen to you than to have it happen to you and try and fix it. Right. And so, so that's the whole idea behind prevention is, what can we do? What can we identify and look as the big factors that will really help people not head down that path again? And, it's interesting. As a society, we're doing better than we ever have, right? Mm. We understand better. We're talking better. But in some ways, we're doing worse than we ever have. That idea that there's a personal component to a lot of this that is up to you, it's immutable, right? You can't,
right.
No matter what you do, you can't force anybody to eat this or do that or whatever. It's got to come from their own self-awareness and their own desire to follow through and make it a part of their life. We talked about that with sleep a lot, right?
So. Yeah, for sure. Do you think that it is in the best interest of, number one, the medical industry, number two, the pharmaceutical industry, for us to be sick, for us to continue to have problems? I mean, we talked a little bit about the weight loss drugs and how, Eli Lilly or any of these big companies, they're losing out on future profits for statins and other, medicines if they distribute these weight loss medicines. I know that's a tough question.
You're not asking me any easy questions now. Let's go back to easy questions.
Okay.
My experience is that people in the medical field really want to help people.
Yeah.
They go there for the right reasons.
There are exceptions, obviously, but
there's always exceptions. Yeah. And so I don't know if that's what the question is getting to, but I don't perceive that that there's an inherent evilness behind anybody.
Yeah.
I wonder if sometimes the system favors certain ways of doing things that sometimes it forgets other things, right? And I wish we could have a way to be more inclusive in the medical field. My favorite story about that is, his name was Semmelweis. Have you heard the story of Semmelweis?
I don't think so.
He was a physician. He started looking around and noticing that the physicians that delivered babies, there was like a 60% fatality rate in the babies. But the nurses that delivered babies, far less, 5% fatality rate.
Oh, wow.
And then he started asking the question, well, what are they doing differently, the nurses versus the doctors? And he found out that the nurses were washing their hands before they were delivering babies, where the doctors were taking it as a badge of honor to have as much blood caked up on there as they could as they delivered babies and they went around. So he made the very simple suggestion, hey, we need to wash our hands when we're delivering babies.
And that wasn't well accepted.
But he was universally ridiculed and run out of the medical profession, died in an insane asylum, to be
honest. Wow.
So you may say, well, that was a long time ago. We're much different now. There's always this attitude that what I learned in medical school is right and what you're trying to talk about is wrong.
Yeah.
You have to overcome every time a new thing comes. And it's not a criticism. It's just if it's worked in the past, we should keep with it. And I think sometimes we need to figure out how to get to a better balance in some of this stuff of we got to find the best stuff that works for everybody and not entrench ourselves in our society or medical system, whatever it is we're at. And I'm not articulating very well, but I think humility is always a virtue.
Yes, it is. And, one of the big ones, I think.
Sometimes I don't see that in my profession.
It's hard because a lot of people come to a doctor. They go to a doctor and assume he knows everything.
Yeah.
And it's hard to be humble when the people come to you and they say, please tell me what to do. I don't know anything and you do. And so I understand
that. And that's the expectation is that you'll know everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes the ability to say, I'm going to do a little more research here and figure something out a little deeper. Those are the guys that you want to go to. The doctors that you say, wow, they really made a difference in my life. So.
Now, we only have a minute left, but what about pharmacy? I learned a long time ago that friends are friends, but money is money. And unfortunately, money talks in almost every situation. And these big pharmacy companies, they stand to lose money on a lot of stuff if these GLP-1 medicines are as good as they're advertised.
Yeah, I don't know. Let me think about
that
one. Because I don't
perceive,
I think, where would we be without the pharmaceutical industry,
right,
too.
No, that's absolutely.
The problem is there's this balance of how do you, what's appropriate, how much money should they make? I mean, those are all questions that I think we're grappling with as a society that are a lot, lot harder than, oh, everybody's evil. I think it's another topic. So.
All right, we'll talk about it another day. I don't think anyone can begrudge them for making money. I mean, that's what America and capitalism is. But how much is too much?
Yeah.
And how much
ways to find that?
We're out of time. Thanks so much for listening today. Mayor Randall on tomorrow here on The Andy Griffin Show. We'll see you then.